Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Local leaders and immigration advocates are responding to yesterday's mass arrest in the South Loop. Illinois State Police are sharing data with federal immigration authorities. How this agreement may complicate the state's so-called sanctuary laws. And Venezuelan elections took place last month, and some residents are pushing back against the result. How it impacts Venezuelans living here. And now to some of today's top stories. Governor J.B. Pritzker is reacting a day after mass arrests by federal immigration agents in Chicago's South Loop. The action by ICE sparked outcry as advocates gathered to protest the operation.
There were bystanders who were protesting, not interfering, but simply protesting and expressing their First Amendment rights and freedoms. And yet those ICE officers were pushing people out of the way in a fashion that I don't think any of us think is right. And I have to say, they overstep constantly, one time after another, at the federal level.
At least 10 people were detained by federal immigration agents after being told to check in to a monitoring program administered by ICE. That's according to elected officials and organizers. An older person who was at the scene reported being struck with a baton and thrown to the ground by agents. We'll hear directly from that alderman later in the program. Illinois officials are warning about unhealthy air quality as wildfire smoke from Canada is rolling into the state. The Illinois Environmental Protection Agency says pollution levels could create health concerns for those with respiratory or pulmonary disorders. The National Weather Service is encouraging residents to consider making outdoor activities shorter and less intense. Those pollution levels are expected to last in the area until Friday. The Canadian fires have forced more than 27,000 people to evacuate. Passengers flying in and out of Midway Airport may notice some runway construction, but the city says it won't impact your travel plans.
So many heavily used pieces of pavement around us. Regular maintenance isn't optional, it's essential. The current airfield pavement needs rehabilitation to maintain safety and reliability to avoid any unexpected closures or emergency repairs, which would significantly impact air service.
The Department of Aviation today broke ground on a $47 million runway rehabilitation project for one of the airport's primary runways. Construction will include repaving the main runway and its intersecting taxiways, plus installing new runway guard lights and a new roadway to support aircraft rescue and firefighting in the event of an incident. Aviation says the city is still seeking more than $37 million in federal funding through the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the FAA Airport Improvement Grant Program. Chicago White Sox may be getting a new owner. First, this note, though, to fans who've been clamoring for Jerry Reinsdorf to sell the team. That deal won't happen until 2029 at the earliest, or maybe 2034, or never. But the Sox did announce today what they call a, quote, long-term investment agreement. The plan paves the way for Reinsdorf to sell majority control to billionaire Justin Ishbia. Exactly when or even if it'll happen is still a bit unclear. Ishbia and his brother own the NBA's Phoenix Suns. Reinsdorf has been White Sox chairman since buying the team with Eddie Einhorn in 1981. The team is currently 20-43 on the season. They fell to the Detroit Tigers this afternoon, 3-2. Coming up in the program, Illinois State Police has been sharing its gang member data with ICE, despite an Illinois law prohibiting data sharing between the agencies. But up next, mass arrests by federal immigration agents in the South Loop yesterday caused a chaotic scene. We hear from the folks who were there.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Immigrant advocates and local officials are calling out federal immigration agents today following a face-off yesterday in the South Loop. ICE agents reportedly detained at least 10 people yesterday after they were told to check into a monitoring program administered by the agency. Tensions escalated as ICE agents were seen pushing back some of the immigrant advocates who gathered to protest the actions, with an older person saying he was thrown to the ground. The incident has sent shockwaves through immigrant communities as advocates say the people arrested were following the rule of law. Joining us now are Cynthia Fernandez, a lawyer representing a woman who was detained yesterday, and Anthony Quezada, 35th Ward Alderman. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Alderman Quezada, you and several other older people, you were there to resist the arrest. Tell us what happened once you got there.
So when we arrived on scene, we saw a number of community members who were family members or residents or neighbors of the people who had been detained. We're trying to find out what was going on. When we arrived, we also saw Chicago police officers on the scene, which was a little concerning because we knew that this was an ICE operation, that there was federal agents, HSI was on scene, and we were wondering why Chicago police officers were there when we have sanctuary laws, when we have the Trust Act. So we wanted to ascertain if there was any sort of collaboration happening. So myself, Alderwoman Rosana Rodriguez, Alderman Byron Sixto-Lopez, started to ask officers on the scene, including the commander of the 1st District, what they were doing there. They came to tell us that there was a distress call, that someone made a call to the Office of Emergency Management saying that there was police in distress. We didn't see anybody in distress. No police officers were in distress. The people who were in distress were the children there who were trying to find out what happened to their parents.
You also said that you were assaulted by an ICE agent. What happened?
So at one point after the Chicago Police Department left the area, ICE was trying to bring in vans into the building's parking lot. That is when myself, Alderwoman Rosana Rodriguez, and Cook County Commissioner Jessica Vasquez engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience, practicing our First Amendment rights to stand there and to, in solidarity and in compassion and love for our residents and constituents who were being detained.
To block the driveway.
Correct. And shortly after, ICE agents then got out of vehicles, about over three dozen of them. They cleared out the street, they cleared out the sidewalk, armed, masked, fully masked, and then aggressively made their way into the driveway in which we were standing in. An ICE officer or HSI agent grabbed me and threw me to the ground. I fell into a puddle, got wet, and then as they continued to make their way into the building, there were multiple altercations in which they were using their batons to push community members. They, you know, punched me kind of like in the gut area. And then when they started to bring out the detained individuals, which is one of the most horrifying scenes I've ever experienced in my life, I'm completely distraught still to see community residents, mothers, people in handcuffs being taken into vans, crying with their family members and their neighbors on the sidelines crying as well. It was a very disturbing scene.
Cynthia Fernandez, what did you experience yesterday at the scene?
So it was just as he mentioned, it was very scary. Everybody was masked. There was a lot of guns. One had like a sniper rifle. I was there at 10 a.m. with my client. She had received a text message that said she needed to come in. She's been here for 10 years, had an active, valid work permit, so she had no reason to fear. But I did tell her that we were scared she would be detained. As her attorney, I went there and I assumed I was going to be able to talk to the ICE officer and speak about the case, any questions they had. However, I was not allowed in. The ISAP employee told me that the ICE officer was in the building, but he would not be speaking to me and he would not receive any documents from me. I was there until about 2:45 when they told me that she was going to be detained and that they were not going to speak to me. I was there until 6 and I wasn't able to speak with my client or any ICE officer as to why she was detained.
What's the next step for her? What recourse do you have now?
Legally, we can file a stay. That is her right as being here for 10 years, two U.S. citizen children, and a legal permanent resident child. However, I was not allowed to file it yesterday, and when I went to the building today, they told me to come back tomorrow at 8 a.m., even though it was 2:45 p.m., and the office is open until 4:30. I asked if I could speak with someone, if there was another reason as to why this couldn't be submitted. They said to come back at 8 a.m. So I did speak with the ICE officer today that has her detained and said that she would be deported as soon as possible. I informed him that I'm trying to file a stay. He said, however, he seems that it's very likely she will be deported as soon as possible.
So then you haven't been able to speak with her either?
I was able to speak with her on speakerphone while the ICE officer was with her.
Okay, so then she's probably not allowed to say.
I'm not able to speak with her as an attorney, mm-hmm. right? Client privilege, mm-hmm. I have not been able to, and they were not able to tell me where she would be sent. As of today, she still is not in the system, so I know she's detained because I was there, but if we look it up in the system, she doesn't come out
the
as being detained.
The record does not exist mm-hmm. yet. Okay. The City Council Latino Caucus said in a statement, quote, "We stand united in calling for a full investigation into the conduct of ICE agents involved in this operation and for the immediate release of all individuals detained under these unlawful circumstances. The Immigrant and Refugee Rights Committee will convene a hearing to examine the extent of ICE's misconduct and to determine whether the Chicago Police Department played any role in today's actions." And I do want to mention the statement that's been reported from the CPD that says, quote, "All actions taken by CPD during this incident was in accordance with CPD policy and the City of Chicago Municipal Code. No arrests were made by CPD and the crowd dispersed without incident." Alderman Quezada, what happens next? How are local leaders responding to this?
I'm grateful that they issued a statement. I had an opportunity to speak with Superintendent Snelling last night. But as I told the superintendent, the people that he needs to answer to and that the Chicago Police Department needs to answer to is the people of Chicago. There are laws in place, local and at the state level, and we need to have a full investigation and hearing as to the policies and protocols that were being practiced. I want to know who made that call. Who was in distress? Why? And when police officers were there, why were they in the building while an active operation was taking place? So I'm not saying that there is, you know, any foul activity, but we need to have answers because the perception from the community residents that were there, from the advocates, was that there was collaboration. We need to instill confidence and trust between the Chicago Police Department, between our communities, and between our undocumented and immigrant population. So I look forward to the full collaboration and cooperation of the Chicago Police Department as we ask these questions and answer what happened.
So what officially? Hearings, investigation, what would you
FOIA
like to
see? FOIA requests. I would love to see body cam footage. I'd love to hear the audio from that OAMC call. We need to gather all the data so that we have a good understanding of what transpired and if there needs to be any reforms to any of the policies and protocols that were enacted that day. And also, you have to think about, that was a lot of public resources that HSI, you know, incurred to the people of Chicago. Are we going to send them an invoice? Are they going to pay for the police officers that were dispatched or for the vehicles and the gasoline that was used? I don't know, but we're going to find out.
Cynthia, you know, it looks like things with your client's deportation moved really quickly after being taken into custody. And some advocates are saying that this was a form of entrapment. What do you make of that?
She received a message from the ISAP agency where she is every day monitoring, right? It said, "Please come in. We want to speak with you." She responded as to when. She said, "Next day." And they said, "Why?" Didn't respond. She said, "What address?" Because we still didn't know where to go. And they said, "Well, the ERO officer has to speak with you." ERO is at 101. Why is she
ERO,
being sent?
Sorry, tell us what that stands for.
Yeah, enforcement removal officer. So the question is, why was she sent to the ISAP office? I believe that was a runaround in order to make sure that the attorney couldn't come in with him. Right. And so I think that's one of the ways that they were trying to make sure that we weren't able to come in and speak with them and explain the situation. Like I said, she's been here for 10 years. She has done everything they asked. And many of the people that were there without attorneys had no idea they were going to be detained that day. So a lot of them actually spoke to my client and had her call me and give me their information because no one was there to pick up their children. And so we got text messages that said, "I've been detained. Please let this person know they have to go get my children."
Okay. So a lot of unanswered questions, more to come, I'm sure, I hope. That's where we'll have to leave it for now, though. Cynthia Fernandez and Alderman Anthony Quezada, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Up next, why Illinois State Police may be violating state law. Illinois State Police maintain a database of suspected gang members, and they make that information available to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement despite state law prohibiting data sharing agreements between state law enforcement and federal immigration authorities. WTTW News reporter Blair Paddock joins us now with more. Blair, what is in these data sharing agreements?
Yeah, so we got agreements between Illinois State Police and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Department of Homeland Security, and then DHS's Enforcement and Removal Operations, who actually detains and removes people for data within the state's statewide computer system, which is known as LEADS, or the Law Enforcement Agency's data system. And that contains a gang member file. We've seen the Trump administration use oftentimes flimsy evidence to deport people on alleged gang ties. And so there's a concern that there could be information shared.
What's the Illinois state law that prohibits these data sharing agreements?
So the Trust Act was passed in 2017, and it's generally prohibits state law enforcement and local law enforcement from assisting federal immigration authorities. And there's a line explicitly prohibiting local law enforcement agencies from entering data sharing agreements with federal immigration authorities. We asked the Illinois Attorney General, who enforces the Trust Act, as to whether or not this breaks the Trust Act, and they did not respond when we provided these agreements.
Governor J.B. Pritzker is testifying about this law next week. How did he react to this?
Yeah, we heard from a spokesperson for the governor who sent us a statement saying all our agreements with law enforcement agencies are standard criminal justice information sharing agreement. LEADS is not designed to collect immigration status information. Any agency, including ICE, using LEADS for purposes in violation of state or federal law would be violating the terms of our standard LEADS agreement. The Pritzker administration's operation of LEADS is fully in compliance with state and federal law.
Okay, so that's the governor. What was the concern then from civil liberty and immigration advocacy groups?
Yeah, we heard from the ACLU, who brought up Chicago's faulty gang database, for example. It's now decommissioned, but at the time when it was operating, it contained people who were 0 to 117 years old, alleging that they were gang members, and there wasn't a system for people to remove themselves. With gang databases, it can use speculative information to allege gang ties, such as tattoos or emblems on T-shirts. And so they're concerned that speculative information could get people on this database, and then ICE could use that information to deport people. And like I said at the beginning, Trump administration has been used flimsy evidence to deport people on gang ties.
Okay. Blair Paddock, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Good reporting.
Thanks.
And you can read Blair's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. Latin American countries are in the midst of a crucial election year, including in Venezuela. The country's ruling party claimed another win last month amid opposition boycotts. Opposition leaders called for voters to abstain from casting ballots in protest of last July's contested presidential election results. Advocates say last month's results, where many voters stayed home, could further roil the country's political landscape. Here with more on this topic and to explore the impact on U.S. relations and Venezuelans in Chicago are Ana Gil Garcia, co-founder and chair of the board of directors of the Illinois-Venezuelan Alliance, and via Zoom, Alberto Cole, professor of law and U.S. foreign relations at DePaul University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Ana Gil Garcia, Venezuela has had two crucial elections. Of course, last year, the presidential, and most recently, the gubernatorial race. How have voters responded to this most recent election?
Well, the situation in Venezuela really hasn't changed in terms of how voters have responded. Unfortunately, the July 2024 election was an election that was, we all think when we saw, how people went to the street and how people, they went to the polls and the enthusiasm that people really showed about that election. And then finally, just knowing that the president that was named was, Maduro, there is a lack of faith in the system. There is no way that people went back again, just to do what? you know, what is the reason just to go to vote? So I believe that, you know, this is going to happen for many years. You know, people really in Venezuela, unless they see there is a clear evidence of change, you know, people will not really go into to expose themselves, you know, to something that is not going to happen seriously.
Professor Cole, what impact will these elections have on mass migration and immigration?
Well, that's a very complicated issue because you have to look at exactly the Trump administration's policies on Venezuelan migration, which right now the Trump administration has been very clear that it will not accept any more immigrants from Venezuela. And in fact, the Trump administration is very busy deporting Venezuelan migrants back to Venezuela. So Venezuela, as Anna pointed out, has been a major disaster, a catastrophe for decades now. And what these recent elections did was that they confirmed the sense that, you know, the opposition called for a boycott precisely because last year they won the presidential elections very cleanly. This was confirmed by numerous international observers and by very, very clear evidence. And yet Maduro ignored those results and has stayed in power. So this time around, the opposition said, well, why should we participate in these elections, which are just for show? And so they boycotted. In some districts, by the way, the boycott rate was about 80% of eligible voters did not vote for these parliamentary elections. As many as 80, anywhere between 60 and 80% of voters did not vote for these parliamentary elections. So now Maduro, of course, is claiming a great victory, but it's a hollow victory.
Yeah. Ana, how are community members here being impacted by the circumstances in Venezuela?
Well, you know, the circumstances in Venezuela, when we see that, the administration, the Trump administration right now, you know, they're claiming in terms of eliminating the TPS, the temporary protected status, one of the things that they are claiming is that situation in Venezuela changed. You know, the situation has improved. So definitely, I mean, that's a consequence of something that we say, well, no. Because there are a lot of evidence that really tells us that the situation has not improved. We still have families in Venezuela. We still have, you know, people that we are shipping goods and food and medicines and, you know, medical equipment, all those things, because the situation has not improved. So the community is emotionally despair. That's true, because we don't know really what is going to happen next. There is always a next, and so it's always you know, just thinking about, okay, am I going to stay? Am I going to leave? But where to leave?
Right. Well, and what
we
could
don't
happen
have exactly?
Right. So if Venezuelans seeking asylum in Chicago or in the U.S. for that matter, if they are forced to return to Venezuela, what might their lives be like? What could happen for them?
Well, what is going to we've seen already that, you know, when Venezuelans they go back, the ones that have been already deported, they have been taken to prison. They have been put away from their families and their communities. So it's not really a very easy situation for anybody who wants to go back. I wish that somebody really could say, yes, going back to Venezuela is the safest, you know, place right now to go back, but it's not.
That's not the case. Professor Cole, I want to talk about Mexico because they just had their first judicial election this past Tuesday. Now that, you know, judges have been elected, what might change in the political landscape there and the country?
I think it's not good news. And I think that we all should worry about what's happening in Mexico. What we're seeing in Mexico is the gradual growth of what I call soft authoritarianism. It's not authoritarianism through an outright coup or tanks on the streets, but it's an authoritarianism through which the ruling party, the Morena Party, has a lock on the Congress. And they created this new system in which judges are elected. What does this mean? It means that to be a candidate for a judge, you have to be on a list. And that list has to be cleared by the Senate. Who controls the Senate? The ruling party, which has a majority in it. So that means that in these recent elections for judges, the government-sanctioned candidates won appointment. And you're looking at appointments for 9 years in the case of the judicial judges, 6 years for those judges on the electoral tribunals, a very important body in Mexico, which is being totally undermined by these so-called reforms. So the election of judges means the election of judges that have been appointed, that have been cleared, that have been approved by the party-controlled Senate. So I think we're going to see this kind of authoritarianism. It also means that these judges are going to be much more pliable to the drug cartels in Mexico, which will affect the United States quite directly.
Of course it will. Professor Cole, Alberto Cole there at DePaul University, and Ana Gil Garcia, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and at 7 for the Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.